ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Ross Gittins is known as the Great Explainer. For five decades now, Ross's work as an economics columnist has helped to demystify the strange and magical and unnatural workings of the Australian economy for millions of readers. In his time at the Sydney Morning Herald, Ross Gittins has written more than 5,000 columns. He's worked for 16 editors, one of whom lasted 24 hours. Ross has covered 50 budgets, 19 federal elections, and he's seen 11 prime ministers and 16 treasurers come and go, starting with Gough Whitlam and Frank Crean. He's seen seismic changes in our economy and in our place in the world. When he started work in the 1970s, governments set the price of eggs, bread, and petrol, and your pay arrived in little brown paper packets stuffed with notes and coins. Well, maybe not stuffed, actually. But for Ross, his mission is just the same as it was 50 years ago, to make the sometimes arcane science of economics make proper sense to everyday people and to explain all kinds of things that entrenched interests would rather you did not know. Hello, Ross.
Hi, Richard.
You're a Salvation Army kid, brought up within the Salvation Army family. What values were inculcated to you by your Salvation Army upbringing?
I guess that people mattered, that people in difficulties mattered, poor people. You read the New Testament, you find Jesus was always banging on about the poor. Not all the churches are still banging on about the poor, but that's one of the things that stayed with me, and I care about that.
Supporting people who are hard to love is a big thing with the Salvos too, isn't it?
Well, it is, yes. One of the things they had was that they were very much against people who divided the world into the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. That's because they were trying to help the undeserving poor, the fallen women and the drunks and the people who are just out of jail. That's where the Salvos started in the East End of London. The trouble with being a Salvationist is they have all these very healthy habits. They don't drink, they don't smoke, they don't believe in gambling, and they don't go out anywhere apart from going to the hall for the meetings.
I mean, you and I live that way today, Ross, but we don't object to other people doing it, do we? Tell me how your parents, Catherine and Harold, met each other.
My father was a Salvation Army lieutenant who one time found himself in charge, or maybe he was helping a captain of some little Salvation Army church in North Queensland. And there was this shy young woman there, and they took a shine to each other. They had very complementary personalities, I think.
How so?
Well, my mother provided the brains and my father provided the brawn. He was always looking for little women who needed to be looked after. The chief little woman was my mother.
And how about your mum? What kind of a life did she have within the Salvation Army?
Well, the first thing to know is that she was just as much qualified, ordained as my father. That was the way the Sallys worked. So that she could marry my father, she came from North Queensland to the Salvation Army's training college in Petersham in Sydney. She was ducks of the course, not because she was trying to be, but just because she was a conscientious, intelligent kind of person. I don't think my father came anywhere near being ducks, but she was a person who, like everyone then, left school at the age of about 12. My father left school at 12, but she kept studying. She read widely. She did a lot of correspondence courses that were organised for Salvation Army officers by the headquarters in London. And she educated herself. When I was a boy, one of my jobs used to be to go to the local library and get six books I get some for myself, but I get six for my mum. I'd bring them home. She would read them, or she'd read as many of them as she wanted to read. And then a week later, I'd take them back and get another six.
Wow. She could, like, read about six books a week if she wanted to.
Yeah, she wouldn't necessarily read every word, but yes.
She could work on this program if she was still around. Ross, that's what's required with this job.
This is one of her skills that I have not inherited.
What was the work of being a salvo in those days?
There are two parts to the Salvation Army. There are the people you hear about who, you know, go to the war to help the soldiers, and they go to fires to give firemen cups of tea. That's the social side. The other side is that the Salvation Army is really just a very small Protestant church. And my father was on that side. So he went to these congregations, these churches, in the back blocks of Queensland and New South Wales. And he was just a local minister.
A preacher?
Ostensibly, they were there to save souls, and we had a lot of open-air meetings. I would stand on a street corner with my mother and my father and my sisters and sing songs. And
with the brass band?
At a lot of the churches, course, that we went to, they didn't have a brass band. But if we had one, we would be with them.
If you think about it, brass bands were like rock and roll for the 19th century. There was the music that was quite exciting and youthful, you know, Sousa's music and all that. It was in some ways, it was a predecessor to rock and roll.
Yes,
so
it was a great fad and fashion of the middle of the 19th century in Britain and certainly in northern England. Collieries have bands and all of that sort of thing. So this is some strange cultural thing that the salvos have stuck with long after it ceased to be quite so fashionable.
You grew up in Australia where being socially conspicuous was considered a severe crime. So to stand there in uniform with a brass band playing, did you feel a bit like you stuck out in the world doing that?
Well, I did. I knew that I was part of some kind of weird religious sect, uniformed sect. But at the same time, it was the only life I knew. And my parents wanted me to be there helping. You know, if your parents own a corner store, you have to help out in the shop. I had to help out in the corps. I had little jobs to do that my father and my mother were relying on me to do, and I did them, happily.
Tell me what you found out years later about your dad's early years as a Salvation Army officer.
Well, my father was in charge of these very small churches in the back blocks of Queensland during the Depression, when they had this thing called the SUSO, the sustenance payment, which was really, it was the forerunner to unemployment benefits. It's where we started calling it the dole. And one of the rules was that they would give you this stuff, money, I guess a bit of money and some maybe some produce or something, but you couldn't stay in the one spot. You had to keep moving around.
Is that why so many unemployed people were itinerant during the Great Depression?
Yes, the system obliged them to. In theory, they were searching for work. They probably didn't find much of it, but that's what they were doing. And they were all moving around. And somehow or other, they got to know that if you came to the town that my father was in, you came to the back door of his manse, we used to call it the quarters, and he would help you.
How would he do that?
He had these sunshine milk tins, and he got some wire, and he turned them into little billy cans. He'd put in there potatoes that he'd grown himself. He'd put in dripping that he'd saved from our household cooking and say, there you go, that's one meal. He would look at your feet. And he'd say, well, your soles seem very worn since you're doing all this walking around. But that's okay. I've got a shoemaker's last, and I've got this old tyre, and I'll cut a bit off the old tyre, and I'll make a new sole for your shoe.
He was saving souls. Both kinds of souls.
He probably saved more of those kind of souls than a lot of others.
Oh, he sounds like he was a wonderful man, by the sound of things. And was there much money to go around in your early life as a family? This is post-depression, of course, but nonetheless, was there the booming 50s and 60s? Was there much money around?
There was enough, but my father had to work hard for it. It was really a question of whether my father could afford to bring up four kids on the small stipend of a Salvation Army officer. And I'm told that his boss gave him £5 out of his own pocket to help him with all the extra expense of me coming along. So it was pretty tight. But my parents were used to it. They didn't complain about it. They didn't worry about it. But they made sure they made every penny that they spent work. One of the ways they saved money was never buying newspapers. When I went to apply for a job at the Herald, a standard question would be, you know, what do you like in the Herald? I was glad they never asked me because I never read the Herald. I didn't read the Herald until I was working for them.
You've got this cultural memory. You're old enough to have a memory of an Australia where there was more communitarianism but more sectarianism at the same time.
Oh, yes.
It's almost all gone. It's almost entirely gone. Can you sort of, when you think about that, how great are the changes you see in your mind?
Well, enormous. The world doesn't work like that anymore. Even people who are only on the minimum wage probably don't have to scrimp and save as hard as my father did. Standards of living have risen enormously, of course. But the other thing is that the biggest change that I could tell you about lots of changes that I've seen. One of the biggest is the way money has turned from being something that was in notes and coins to being stuff that you carried on a plastic card. These days you carry it on your phone. You don't get paid in notes and coins. You just get paid by the boss making a deposit in your account. So you never really see it all.
Handle it.
Mm. You don't handle it. And that actually, I think that makes it a lot harder for people to make sure they don't spend more than they should, because it's very easy to put something on a credit card, say, well, I don't really have to pay for it. I don't have to pay for it now, but rest assured you will have to pay for it.
Tell me how your mum found herself publishing your dad's sermons. What was her role in all that, Ross?
Well, this was when we were in Newcastle. The Newcastle Herald, in those days it was called the Newcastle Morning Herald. I don't know where they got that name from. But they had this column every Monday morning in the paper called From the Pulpit. And what that involved was they set up this roster of ministers who would give them their sermon notes, and then probably the most junior cadet on the Herald would get this sermon notes and turn it into something that could be published in the Newcastle Herald. The first time my father's name came up on that roster, he gave them his notes. What appeared in the Newcastle Morning Herald the next day bore no relationship to anything that he would have said or would have wanted to say, because some young cadet had a lot of trouble making any sense of my father's notes. So my mother was not happy about this. And so from that moment on, every time my father's name came up on the roster, she would write out his sermon. She would give a copy of the sermon to him, which he would preach, and he'd give a copy of another copy to the newspaper, which would publish it almost word for word. And that, by the way, is the reason I know that any skill that I have as a journalist came from my mother.
That's the way the world was in those days, where clever and talented women would have to do it through the name of their husband so often, wouldn't they?
Yes. Yes, it was.
Did you ever imagine being an officer in the Salvation Army yourself, Ross?
Well, I did. In the enthusiasm of my youth, in my great period of religious enthusiasm, I thought, yes, I'd like to be a Salvation Army officer. But then I realised the main reason why I'd like to do it is because I wanted to prove that I could do it better than my father. And I, to this day, I'm sure I could have done it better than my father.
It's not very sound, though, is it?
But it's not exactly the way you're supposed to get a falling.
So then what diverted you to doing a course in accountancy after that?
Well, I was studying accounting at school, Newcastle Boys High. And I was quite well, did quite well at it. I could understand it. I enjoyed it.
Accountancy is something that some people love, but a lot of people find hard and unpleasurable. What did you find was satisfying and enjoyable about accountancy?
Well, I could get it right. I could ensure that the debits equal the credits. And I had a fair idea of when you did a debit and when you did a credit. And it was just a simple bookkeeping kind of thing, which wasn't hard for a person to get on top of. And I got good marks. I got better marks in accountancy than I did in anything else. Certainly better marks than I did when I was studying economics at high school.
Was the idea that you consider get debits to equal credits have a thing of moral value too? Was there a sense of that?
Well, I doubt that. No, I doubt that. But no, the thing was that my father had to do the books for the church every week and send it into headquarters. And he had terrible trouble with that. He was not good at doing the books. And he was very much in awe of other Salvation Army officers who were good at that, including his younger brother, who was an officer who had absolutely no trouble with it. And my father used to call these people office johnnies. He wasn't an office johnny. He was an outdoor kind of guy. But I thought to myself, I could be an office johnny. I reckon I'd have no trouble doing that. So that was all part of the very, very limited worldview that I had that said, yeah, I'll do that.
And not just be an accountant, a chartered accountant. That has such prestige in those days and probably still does as well.
It still does, yes. And that was very important to me. When I first left high school, somebody came to the school and said, I need a junior audit clerk. Can you recommend anyone? And my English teacher recommended me. He probably knew that I was doing well in accounting. And I took that job with alacrity. Now, he was just a little guy practising in up the top of Hunter Street in Newcastle, but he was a chartered accountant. And I quickly realised that there were sort of classes of accountants, and the chartered accountants were at the top. Chartered meant that you're just an accountant, but we have a charter from the Queen setting up our institute. And so you're down there and we're up here. And I fancy that.
So that took you to uni. I'm guessing this was, what, the late 60s or thereabouts, Ros? Is this?
Yes, second half of the 60s.
Right, now we're talking the swinging 60s here. This is miniskirts, rock and roll, European movies. Did you become more culturally aware? Were you brought into the kind of permissive society of the time?
I wasn't. I lived a very sheltered and ordered life. And I didn't do a lot of playing around of any description until I eventually revolted against the one part of the whole Salvation Army ethos that I didn't like, which was you weren't allowed to go to the movies because the movies were worldly.
Was that the phrase?
Worldly, yes, it was. My mother and all the women I knew, they didn't wear makeup, they didn't wear jewellery because it was worldly.
Not even a Frank Capra movie? You couldn't go and see It's a Wonderful Life or something, anything
no,
at all?
Nothing at all. In fact, there was a film that was very popular among Christian people at the time called A Man Called Peter. Now, I can't remember what it was about. What I can remember is my father preaching these fiery sermons about the evils of going to the pictures to see A Man Called Peter.
So how did you then take off to San Francisco from there?
Well, that was after I'd finished university in Newcastle. I had a still had a little bit to finish in Sydney, but I went to Sydney, which was partly because I was 21 and was allowed to leave home. And I would, the idea of
allowed to leave home?
Well, yes, that was. It was one of my mother's rules, and I knew it was one of my mother's rules because my sister, my elder sister, met the man that she wanted to marry when she was about 14, and my mother wouldn't have a bar of any of it until she was 21.
Here is wisdom, Ross, I suspect. Here is wisdom nonetheless. So, okay, been given the permission slip to leave, you went to San Francisco?
No, I went to work for this big firm of chartered accountants in Sydney. After I'd been there a while, they had this system where the American part of the firm, in their busy season, didn't have enough people to do all the grunt work for the audits that they did. And so they would invite people from other countries, English-speaking countries, to come for a period of about 3 months for the busy season to help out. And the Americans had this thing where they paid you the lowest amount per day that the tax code would allow them to pay you without it being taxable. They thought it was pretty low and cheap. We thought it was good money. And so we went there and did that. Now, the thing about that was that I was working for this American firm, and I got a very clear impression from my supervisors that they didn't think I was particularly good, that I was a bit slow. They kept saying, "Are you finished yet?"
Oh, dear.
But at the same time, I got news from Sydney that I had passed my last exam to become a chartered accountant.
All hail the chartered accountant.
Yes. And I found this, it was elating to discover that I'd passed the exam that I didn't think I had. But then it became actually the most disillusioning period of my life, really.
Why?
Because I had convinced myself that as soon as I gained the status of being a chartered accountant, everything else would fall into place.
You could tick that box when they have the list of professionals. Professions, you'd professional, you know, when you have like business, media, professional. You could tick the professional box then.
Yes, you could.
But that didn't make you feel different.
Well, it didn't make me feel that I was any better at accounting. Although what we were really doing was auditing, and auditing is the most boring part of accounting. It's just checking other people's work. I realised that I was good at passing accounting exams. I wasn't very good at being an accountant, and I didn't particularly want to be an accountant.
So what did you do instead, Ross?
I decided I was going to take a year off my career as an accountant. I had about 40 years to go, and I thought to myself, if I take 1 year and do nothing with it, if I just waste it, how much worse will that leave me? And I thought, I'll still have 39 years left. It won't be a problem. So I decided to just take a year off from my accounting career and I'd do something that I enjoyed doing. Now, if I was a normal person, I would have just gone to the beach for a year. But because I was a bit of a nerd, I decided to go back to university and I'd do something that a course that I picked purely because it interested me, not because I was looking for a meal ticket. And I started out doing the first year of the journalism course at what's now UTS.
And how did you like it?
Oh, I loved it.
And how were you then launched into the Sydney Morning Herald from there?
Well, at the end of the year, this journalism lecturer said to me, "Ross, I know you're only here for a year. You're going back to your career, but have you thought of going into journalism?" And I said, "No, I haven't thought about it," because even though I'd done a lot of amateur journalism in the salvos, but I never thought that I could do it because I couldn't spell and I was slow. And then I thought about it and I thought, I've been writing flat out all year. So I thought maybe I could do this. I'd certainly like to. And he said, "Well, I happen to know the cadet council at the Sydney Morning Herald and I can get you an interview." I realised many years later that he didn't just get me an interview. He told this woman that I was good value. And the other thing I didn't realise, I thought I was walking away from my career as an accountant. That was all irrelevant. I was starting at the bottom of a completely different tree. And naturally, I'd accept the pay of a cadet journalist if that's what I had to do to get into journalism. I wasn't worried about the money. I'd dropped a lot of money, but didn't worry me. I was trying to see if I could find something I wanted to do.
And thus you stumbled into the dream job you always wanted but never knew you wanted.
Exactly. But I didn't realise until much later was that these people looked at me and said, this guy's a fully qualified accountant. He's 26, which is pretty old for a cadet. He's mad enough to want to be a cadet journalist instead of an accountant. We could use somebody who was good with figures. So they were very keen to get hold of me. I didn't understand that, but they were. And they've been keen to retain my services ever since.
Podcast. Broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app. Or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
So you joined the Sydney Morning Herald as a cadet and quickly started writing columns thereafter, Ross. This would have been the Whitlam government era when you had Doc Whitlam as Prime Minister, Frank Crean as Treasurer. I remember my dad telling me, and this might have been apocryphal, but he said he once heard Frank Crean say he could fix the economy if he could only find his glasses. They were different times economically then, weren't they?
Frank was a modest man. He was smarter than most of them at the time, and he had studied for that job in the 23 years that the Labor Party was in opposition under Menzies and his successors. Frank Crean had been studying to one day be the Treasurer.
But it was a different world then economically. Australia was so different then. There was much greater government control of the economy, much higher tariff war.
Yes.
I think the considered view at the moment is we were rapidly going down the gurgler economically before the oil shock hit in the early 70s. What's your view on all of that?
Well, we weren't going anywhere, and the whole protective walls that we had to prop up a manufacturing sector when we really didn't have a population big enough to support a decent manufacturing sector, it was one way to do things. Everybody thought it was good. A lot of people would think that the only genuine job is a job that involves doing things with things. If you're just delivering services, you're some kind of flunky, some kind of flack. You're not doing a real job. Now, that is exactly wrong, and that's the way we've moved. We have very few people producing goods, very few people digging up a mine in mines, very few people on farms, and even very few people in manufacturing. And that's mainly been because technology finds it very easy to come up with good machines to make things.
And yet, that culture hasn't changed because a prime minister, no matter what stripe they are, will not announce things unless they're wearing either a high-vis vest in a factory somewhere, because that's the thing that makes quote-unquote real things, or wearing a bushy's hat out in the country somewhere. We still seem to subscribe to that myth that real jobs are the ones where you stick widgets to doohickeys.
Yes, that's true. We do think that. I think it's a declining thing, and it ought to be. And the biggest change in my 50 years of watching the economy has been the emancipation of women. Girls have become better educated and they've got the jobs. They're a growing share of the workforce. The workforce was designed to accommodate men, and we've spent the past 30 or 40 years trying to change it so that it's a good place for women as well.
Have we been successful in that?
We're getting there. And the fact that childcare is so heavily subsidised is a big help. That's one of the factors that evens it up between men and women. But there's a lot more to go. The thing is that women are much more, and this is probably a bit stereotypical, but a lot of the jobs that women have taken have been jobs in the services sector. And the biggest, the other big change that's occurred in my 50 years watching the economy is that the goods part of the economy, the making things, digging them up, growing them, battering them into something, that bit's got smaller. And it's got smaller because they don't need people, they have machines that do it. That means if you want to still want to give everybody a job, you have to have a great growth in the services sector. People think, oh, yeah, services, waiting on tables, cleaning bedrooms. Well, that's only the tiniest bit of it. And at the top is medicine and education, professors, doctors, prime ministers. All the politicians are in the services sector. They don't actually make anything. They just talk.
I suppose I am too, for that matter, now that I think of it. And you and I both, I suppose, in that sense.
So it's now, depending on how you measure it, it's about 80% of all jobs are delivering services. And some of those services are menial, like cleaning an office, and some of them are hugely complicated, like knowing how to build a rocket.
When you first began writing about economics to a broad audience in the paper, what was your aim?
I think that nature intended me to be a teacher. And so I decided that I was going to do something that was very unfashionable at the time, has since become very fashionable, and that is explanatory journalism. I was going to explain, and since they wanted me to talk about the economy, and since my first editor said to me, accountant, economy, same thing, isn't it?
Money.
I thought to myself, this man must be an idiot. But I didn't say that. He said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to be a political journalist. He said, everyone wants to be a political journalist. What we need is people who can write about the economy. This was the Whitlam government, when we were suddenly discovering that if you didn't do it right, the economy could cause you a lot of problems. And so the media discovered the economy under the Whitlam government. Until then, the economy had kind of looked after itself.
Do you know, I have a theory on this, which is that economists and cosmologists are very similar because at their best they explain a whole lot of invisible forces that flow in and around and throughout the universe, if you like. We only often see the end result of these forces that flow. So that's why they're both necessary. If they both share a failing, is that they think that all other branches of human study are sub-branches of their own, essentially. Like, well, really, ultimately, my idea of economics or cosmology sits at the peak and everything flows down from that.
Yes.
What do you think of my theory, Ross?
I agree with it. It's a big failing of economists, and I have tried in my job to say, well, look, the economy is very important. If you're worried about where your next meal is coming from, you care about the economy because that's what it's about. But it's not the only thing that's important. There are other dimensions of your life, and economists can often be very missionary. They want to take all the other bits and change them so that they make the economic bit bigger and better. And I can see that that's not a smart way to run the economy or to run the country, really.
When I try to explain to my kids that when I opened my first bank account, when I started going to uni, I was given a passbook, and very often the entries would be written in pen by what I was taking in or out. Then, of course, they got fancy, you know, printing out, printing out thing on the passbook, and that was another thing. But even as I start to explain this, I can just see their eyes glaze and then look off over the middle distance. It's like I'm trying to explain to them how the steam engine works or something.
No, it's true. It's hard for a kid that's grown up computer literate to understand why their parents have so much trouble, but also to imagine that the world used to be very different and to care that it did. Now, all the oldies care about the change, but they've inherited the new good bit, and they're not all that keen to be told about the old bit.
Donald Horne's famous statement from his book, The Lucky Country, which has so often been misunderstood. I'll quote it again, where he wrote, this is in the 1960s, "Australia is a lucky country run mainly by second-rate people who share its luck. It lives on other people's ideas, and although its ordinary people are adaptable, most of its leaders in all fields so lack curiosity about the events that surround them that they are often taken by surprise." Do you agree that, would you say that we're still in that situation at the moment? This is a very different economy we live in now, but nonetheless, are our leaders still these incurious, unimaginative creatures that Horne is talking about?
Well, I think there's still a lot of truth to that. Yes, I do. It's very easy to say, well, look, this is the way we do it. It's always been. I've had this debate last year when all the economists were saying, oh, yes, whack up interest rates. That's the way it's done. And I'm saying, hang on, you're moving in on these people, particularly young people who've just loaded themselves up with an enormous mortgage as the only way of squeezing into the housing market. And the only way you can think of to solve our problems is to hit those people on the head with a sledgehammer, while the rest of us who don't have big mortgages, this is less true now of the third of households that are paying rent because they've been affected by something that's not really come out of the interest rates. It's really come out of the coincidence that at this time, right now, the number of untenanted properties around is very low. And so if I decide to whack your rent up by $50, or in the case of someone I know, $75 a week, I can do it. Because if you don't like it, go somewhere else, except that there's nowhere else to go, and you might like to live in the park.
This is not just an Australian problem. When people, friends of mine who live overseas, ask how are things going here, I tell them about the housing crisis and they say, oh, it's the same here. It seems to happen all at once and everywhere in the world.
Yes, that's because economists have got themselves into this mentality that when you've got an inflation problem, the only thing to do is whack up interest rates. And I was arguing last year and this year, we have to discourage people from spending so much. Why are firms being accused of gouging, that is, putting up their prices? Well, an economist will say, look, if the demand for this product exceeds the supply, that's what happens. They just do it. Economists call it rationing by price. It makes it's a not much nicer thing to do than to gouge, but it's the same.
Yes.
And so if you want to stop that, you've got to kill off a bit of demand until it's back down equal to supply, and then you won't have prices rising so fast. But there are other better ways to do it, ways that you could share the pain and not just pick on about the quarter of all households that have got really big mortgages. So I've been saying there are other ways to do it, but the economists are saying, no, this is the way we always do it. It works. We know it works. It's always worked. We'll do it again.
But at what cost? That's the
thing.
And
I'm saying, let's have a think about this. Isn't there a better way? I get enough of my readers saying, oh, that sounds interesting, Ross, but I get many economists saying, oh, maybe you're right.
What are some of those other ways you might bring down inflation without raising interest rates so punishingly?
Well, they're all unpleasant because they're all about discouraging
demand.
People who've got plenty of money at the moment from spending so much of it. That's what it's about. It's very crude stuff.
So discourage spending from the wealthy as opposed to people who are just getting by.
Yes. One way to do it would be, this would not be popular, but it would be actually fairer because it would affect a much higher proportion of households than just interest rates. And that is, we could temporarily increase the rate of the goods and services tax. And that would mean that if you keep spending at the rate you are, a lot of extra money will go to the government.
You could raise tax on import taxes, tariffs on luxury goods too.
Well, you could. Economists don't think that's a good idea.
Because once they're there, they're hard to get rid of again. That's why.
Well, yeah, that's true. But the other thing is that Right now, we've got a problem that demand is running faster than supply. So we've got to hit demand on the head and get them back into balance, and then prices won't be rising quite nearly so fast.
Let's go back to housing, because housing is a bit special, isn't it? Because in that ideal economy that doesn't exist, where everything works as it ought to and there's plenty of competition, and you expect supply to reach demand pretty quickly because of prices, as you say. Housing's different. Demand is not something you can really do much about, because people will need to live somewhere, won't they? How is it that we have such a distortion in the economy at the moment where supply does not equal demand? There is such a shortfall between the two that is causing so much pain. I'm hearing about anecdotally, and I'm sure you are, all the time.
Because we've turned home ownership. In the old days, in the post-war period, home ownership was about security of tenure. I own my own home. I'm up to date on my mortgage. No one can touch me. No landlord can say, sorry, you're out. It was about security of tenure. And what's more, I own this place. And if I feel like painting it purple, I will. It's my right. And that's why home ownership was the great Australian dream. It was about saying, there's one bit where the capitalists can't touch me, and that's my own home.
Security and liberty, all in one.
Yes. Mm. But what's happened is we've turned housing also into a good investment. Yeah. And so this is partly why there are so many people getting into buying investment properties, as there used to be. In the old days, you might have some widow who owned a few houses and was living off the proceeds. But now people are just saying, well, will I put this money in the bank? Will I buy some shares in BHP, or will I buy a house?
Now, are we unusual as a country in that so much investment into houses? Because once you've bought a house and you've done the renos, there's not much in that property, that investment, that can stimulate other parts of the economy, is there?
Well, not a lot, but actually a lot of this happened when we started taxing capital gains, which means it didn't start until about 1985, and it got another boost when John Howard changed the way we measured capital gains for tax purposes. But one of the things it means is that if you spend a lot of money turning your modest house into a mansion, then provided you don't make it so much of a mansion that somebody else wouldn't want to pay for it, that's actually a tax-preferred investment. You've put an extra story on, you've added bathrooms and playrooms and everything else, and now you'll be able to sell it for a lot more. And that investment is untaxed because it's part of the family home. That's just one small effect. The other thing is this thing about negative gearing, which is pretty much peculiar to Australia. And that is to say, if you buy an investment property, you can borrow most of the cost of that property. And the beauty of that is that if your interest bill and your other costs exceed the rent that you're getting on the property, that's okay. You can deduct that loss.
Like a business loss.
Yes. You can deduct that loss from your wage income. Now, that's the bit that you can't do in other countries.
Now, negative gearing seems like a perverse thing to me, Ross, because what you're saying is you're pretending to run a business enterprise and you're saying, oh, I didn't make a go of it and I lost money on it, so too bad, and I deserve. There's no element of enterprise in that at all, is there?
No, really? It's speculation. But the thing is, you're not trying to make a profit. Like a normal business, I make a profit out of daily transactions. You're not trying to make a profit out of the rent. You're trying to make a capital gain. And the successive governments, winning government, have not been game to do anything about that.
I remember Paul Keating removed negative gearing for a little while, then reintroduced it.
I don't like people like you. You can remember things we don't want you remembering. I remember that too.
So if I would imagine that if you removed negative gearing, suddenly it would create this disincentive. There would be far fewer bidders at an auction. Therefore, the price of houses would fall, wouldn't it?
Yes. The price of houses that are the kind of houses that are bought by first-time buyers, which are very much the same as the kind of houses bought by investors, they're not mansions.
No.
So that class of house, the price would, the demand would be lower and the price would fall and would probably stop growing as quickly.
And we'd have all these social and economic benefits, one would think, as a result of that. But Ross,
It's very simple. Count the votes. The people who own their home are two-thirds of households, and the people who are renting are one-third. Guess who the politicians are more anxious to keep happy?
Well, another thing we've discovered very recently is that quite a few of those politicians own multiple houses. They are major investors in the property market themselves. That would be a disincentive to remove negative gearing, I would think, as well, Ross?
Yes.
Or is that too cynical?
No, it's not too cynical, but they won't thank you for pointing it out.
Ross, how much of our economic settings are geared against young people?
Oh, well, I think it's incredibly the case. And in particular, another area that is hugely benefits the well-off and the older is superannuation. If superannuation is still far too concessionally taxed. Governments have been trying to haul it back for two decades. But there's more to go. And so wherever you look, the world is stacked up against young people. The rise of the gig economy, it's not old people. Old people have good jobs, for the most part, have good steady jobs that are full-time, where you get annual leave, you get sick leave, but we've invented all these new insecure jobs. Guess who's getting them? Youngsters. We could stop that. We're sort of starting to stop that. But we've really tolerated a situation where the oldies have good jobs and the kids have shitty jobs. Now, why are we doing that? How is that going to make Australia a nicer place to live in 20 or 30 years' time?
It seems to me like we're approaching a similar situation. These things are never directly comparable, I know, but Europe in the middle of the 19th century, where the economy was so geared towards old, rich people and against the young, you had a huge cohort of educated people coming out of their education, finding there were bad prospects for themselves, unstable jobs, low-paid jobs in clerical positions. And in England, you had a situation where that meant you had a lot of young people hovering around the deathbeds of wealthy maiden aunts. And in Europe, revolution. You had revolutions of 1848 led by those young professionals.
We're getting that. And one of the ways we're getting it is through the super system. And I can remember when the Labor Party in opposition wanted to make some fairly small change to the way company profits were taxed, dividends were taxed. And I remember hearing some woman from a fairly wealthy background saying, "It's not me I'm worried about, it's my kids." Hang on, why should we be worried about your kids? This is where the bank of mum and dad is a natural thing to do. I've done it. Every mum and dad that can afford to do it have done it. It makes the problem worse. And it means that the people who don't have a mum and dad who can help them in lose out. We're creating a society where if you don't pick your parents well, you're not going to have a very happy life.
Oh, God help my kids.
Now, that's not a smart way to run the economy or to run a society.
Just finally, Ross, do you have a kind of conversation with your readers over the decades you've been writing your column? Do you correspond with people? I'm sure people write to you to let you know what they think about things.
Well, they do, and they even stop me in the street.
Given you're of a generation, you're not a spring chicken anymore, when you've been writing these columns about how the economy is geared against young people, do you get people of your cohort saying, oh, that's not fair, Ross?
Yeah, yes, that, yeah. I do, but I don't take much notice. I mean, I am trying to support the people who are getting a bad deal, not the people who are getting a good deal. I'm getting a good deal. And I often write things that are contrary to my own interests. But that's I regard that as part of the ethics of being an economics editor. You don't advocate any policy simply because you do well under it. If that's the best you can do, someone ought to take you out and shoot you.
Just finally, is there something you miss about the old Salvos culture? Do you miss the music, for example?
I don't miss the music because I have a computer and it's on the internet. And you don't have to search very hard to find a mighty lot of Salvation Army music. And when I'm sitting up late and at night in my office writing something, you don't know it, but I'm listening to a Salvation Army band playing these hymn tunes where I know all the words. And that can move me to tears because it's cultural. It just brings back my youth and my family.
Ross, what a joy it has been to speak with you, sir. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.